Welcome, correspondent students. Push harder through your morning workout, that is. Okay. Maybe you're listening to it while napping. In that case, I'm sorry. Okay, so first I wanted to say something about the last class, because we had some questions after the prior class. No need for worried looks on your faces. I'm not going to ask Socratic questions about it. Maybe that's why people were confused. Yeah, I got into that Socratic vibe. It was good. I was enjoying it. So just to go back to basics on these, we talked about abandonment, assignment, and licensing. Now, abandonment is when you stop using your trademark. Assignment is when you sell your trademark to someone else. And licensing is when you let someone else use your trademark. You got to understand that first, okay? So I had some questions after class, like, if after I assign my trademark to someone, blah, 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 about using it, well, you can't use it after you've assigned it to someone. If you assign it to someone, you don't have it anymore. You've assigned it to the other person. If you license a trademark to someone else, you can still use it, and they can use it. That's the license. And if it's abandoned, the trademark owner is not using it anymore. Thus, it's abandoned. So we talked about naked licensing and assignment in gross, and I got some questions. After an assignment in gross, if the assignment is determined to be invalid, then who has the trademark at that point? Nobody has the trademark. The trademark has ceased to exist. It's not so much that the assignment's invalid, like in real property, where someone, the original person, keeps it. It's gone. The trademark doesn't exist anymore. Remember, trademark is indication of source. And a trademark has to be an indication of a single source. And when you talk about abandonment and naked licensing and assignment and gross, the thing that all those things have in common with is that the trademark loses its semantic meaning. It loses its ability to denote a particular source. And when the trademark's not doing that anymore, there's no trademark. So after an assignment in gross or after naked licensing, who has a trademark? Nobody does. Or in a sense, everyone does, because everyone can use it. It's open to the world to use. If I said, for instance, X equals half, or 5, or 17, or 5 million, and then I said, would you pay $10 for X bananas? You'd say, well, I don't know. I don't really know what X is. It's one of those things, but that's like trademark. If a trademark comes to mean more than one thing, under abandonment or naked licensing or assignment and gross, then it doesn't function as a trademark anymore. So remember that trademark as a kind of intellectual property is distinct from copyrights and patents in the sense that you can take a copyright, for instance, you can set it on this desk, it will stand up. You can take a patent, you can set it here, it will stand up just by itself. If you take a trademark by itself and you try to set it here, it'll go and just goop all over the desk, because it only exists a pertinent to goodwill that's attached to a good or a service. It's like that hand sanitizing gel, you know? If we put it here, it just goop all over the desk, and then eventually it would evaporate because of its high alcohol content. And it might maybe leave a mark. I'm not even sure about that. So now maybe we should just go back to what is goodwill. Goodwill's easy. Goodwill is the feelings that someone has towards something. So if you say, boy, John's accumulated some goodwill around here by huffing those boxes day and night, even when the lights went out, that means people have good feelings toward him. Okay. Now, goodwill might be really good, or it might be pretty worthless. It's still called goodwill. Now, if I have a trademark in the term MedProds for medical devices. Doesn't that sound nice? Going to the hospital and we're gonna give you a med prod now for medical products. Okay, so and then I'm doing that, and then I sell that trademark to someone with goodwill, of course, because I will put that in the document with all pertinent goodwill, to someone in a candy business who begins manufacturing MedProd's candy, what happens to that trademark? I mean, it's gone. This is the Sugar Busters case. It's gone because you can't transfer goodwill from medical products to candy. The people who had goodwill, certain feelings toward those medical products labeled MedProds, they're not going to... The people who are consuming candy don't have those that feeling toward candy that's labeled MedProds. That goodwill is just going to evaporate like some kind of a gluon. I don't know anything about particle physics, but if you don't, then it's like an escaping positronic emission that just goes off the top of your. I said I wasn't going to do any drawings since people are only listening, but here, if you have this kind of transmogrification, see, of this molecule, the goodwill just goes out there. The goodwill. There you go. See? I secretly wanted a PhD in theoretical physics, but I'm here teaching trademarks. So, at any rate, you try to transfer goodwill, MedProds, from medical products to candy. The goodwill just evaporates out the side of the equation. It's gone. Okay? And that all comes from trademark being indication of source. Everything in this course comes back to that, or comes back to some way in which trademark evolved away from source. That's why it's only 2 credits. Take patent law, it's much more complicated. 3 credits. It's a lot of fun. Take it with me. Okay. I may not be offering it for a while. All right. Any other questions about that? Hopefully that will clear up some things and create new questions about particle physics. But okay, let me give you a very brief lecture on counterfeiting, because it just wasn't... It's in the syllabus, but it just wasn't. There wasn't much use in doing any reading on it, because it doesn't create a lot of interesting case questions. But so that you get the full view of trademark, the Lanham Act. Well, not the Lanham Act. I'm sorry. Federal law provides for criminal penalties for counterfeiting. The criminal penalties are for intentionally trafficking or attempting to traffic in goods or services using a counterfeit mark in connection with those goods or services. If you do that, the U.S. attorney can come after you. They can get... did everyone write that down? Should I say that again? Okay. Intentionally trafficking... This is the crime. Intentionally trafficking or attempting to traffic... You're going to have to get off the Stairmaster and write something down. In goods or services, using a counterfeit mark in connection with those goods or services. I have a couple of them. I don't know where that comes from, frankly. I should have a statutory site. I don't for that. I have a couple statutes coming up. It's in 18 USC, right around the 2300s. So an individual can receive a penalty of up to $3 million or 10 years in jail, which is kind of at least proportionate. You always see those things, a fine of up to $70 or a year in jail. Who, you know, if it were like, yeah, oh, $70 or a year in jail, that's similar. Okay. Maybe in 1792. I can't part with $70. I will spend a year in the jail. And a corporation up to $5 million fine. If you get convicted a second time, those habitual trademark infringers, man, they keep coming back for that powerful high from trademark infringement. An individual can get a fine of up to $5 million and up to 20 years in prison. And a corporation up to a $15 million fine. Quick public survey. Anyone support the death penalty for trademark infringers? 1, 2. Okay. The So a counterfeit mark, and here I have a statutory site for you, 18 U.S.C. 2320. A counterfeit mark is defined as something that is used in, number one, used in connection with trafficking goods or services. Two, it is identical with or substantially indistinguishable from a mark registered on the principal register. One of the benefits of principal registration, or registration on the principal register. And three, the use of which is likely to cause confusion, mistake, or to deceive. Does anyone have kids that watch Thomas the Tank Engine? The Sir Topham Hatt, yeah, he comes out when an engine's done something wrong and he says to the engine, "You have caused confusion and delay." I was about to say confusion and delay there, but jokes that fall flat in an audience of non-parents. Try that, though, at Thanksgiving. "You have caused confusion and delay by not giving me the yams." So they'll think that's funny. So you want me to read those three again? No. Okay. All right.
Is there a similar cause of action common law if they're not registered?
No, it's not a cause of action. First of all, these are elements of a crime for prosecution by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and no is the answer.
So if you're not registered?
Maybe in the states. I don't know. And then the government has to prove that, has to establish the defendant's intent with regard to each one of those elements. One, two, and three. Now, a couple of interesting facts about this. It is not a crime to be carting around counterfeit trademarks like a big bag of Dooney and Burke labels. Why? Anyone? Anyone? Voodoo? Okay, Mr. Jones? Yes! Very good. Exactly. A future criminal defender, Mr. Jones. The criminal defender to the IP field. By the same token, if you have genuine trademarks, genuine labels, and you attach them to non-genuine goods, that is a crime. So if a bunch of genuine Dooney and Burke labels fall off a truck and you stick them on something that's not a genuine Dooney and Burke. Do I have that right? Dooney and Burke is expensive purses? No one will tell me. Okay, thanks. The other statute I wanted to tell you about is 18 U.S.C. 2318. This is like an exception to what I just said about it's okay to run around with bags of counterfeit labels. If this is part of an act that came out in 2004. If the labels that you have, packaging labels, warranty certificates, things like that, are for a copyrightable product, software, DVD movies, sound recordings, albums, books, then just having the labels is a crime. So that is a trademark crime that's aimed at stemming copyright piracy. That's really all I have to say on counterfeiting. Good enough?
Yep.
All right. Let's go on to our first case, which is uh, Kellogg versus Exxon, and who do we have for that? Ms. Blackman.
Yes. So basically, there's this huge long fact pattern of having to deal with Exxon and their use of this whimsical tiger on their tiger mark, and Kellogg's registered Tony the Tiger mark. But basically, Kellogg registered Tony the Tiger in 1952. And soon after that, Exxon started using their whimsical tiger. And all of these things happened. And then basically, Exxon sort of started not using it very much and trying to phase it out because of they were trying to be more serious.
Why were they trying to be more serious?
Because there was some oil spill.
What killed Jimmy Carter's presidency. It was the energy crisis of the 1970s. So these are some of my favorite parts of the case here. At the top of 512. No, that's okay. It's my favorite parts. That's okay. In the early 1980s, Exxon's advertising agency suggested that Exxon phase out the use of the cartoon tiger and begin using a live tiger, opining that the cartoon tiger was too whimsical and hence inappropriate in light of prevalent oil shortages. So America, in light of an oil crisis, demanded the sobriety of a live tiger. Okay.
Okay. So anyway, Exxon and Johnson smoke this really bad. And they start sort of telling their regional managers to sort of phase it out, but it's taking a really long time, and a lot of them aren't doing it. And apparently there's even this one tiger mart that still has this huge tiger up in front of it today. Anyway, so they did renew their registration in 1985.
Let's just go back, make sure we cover that 1984 internal office memo, which is hilarious. Apparently not written by a lawyer, because this was not held out as attorney-client privilege from the document review. Hey, guys, since the only way to protect the trademark is to use it, it might be wise for us to explore ways that the cartoon tiger can be used in marketing on a limited basis. This is not a hot item, but one we can't forget about and be embarrassed later, such as being published in Mags and Schechter's Cases and Materials on Trademark and Competition Law. Okay. But before we move on too much further, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you. Here's a map of the eastern United States with a copyright date of 1981. Apparently went to press right before. It's got the whimsical tiger. He's got a big smile on his face. He's cozying up to this happy Exxon man who has no fear for his life. This is before the Siegfried and Roy thing and the incidents in Florida, but you can pass that around. Okay.
And they lose a lot of them, but basically during the time of this case, then based on these photographs that they still have, they estimated that about 10% of their stores still displayed this cartoon tiger in 1987.
Apparently in violation of some memos, but
right.
They're glad they violated it now.
Right. But then in 1993,
you skipped the early 90s here.
Oh, well, I was going to go back to that.
Oh, okay.
Well, I can do the early 90s.
Here.
Well, they changed, in the early 90s, they changed the appearance of the cartoon tiger to, this is my favorite part, to one that was more endearing and friendly, because today's tiger is now cast in a more humanitarian role.
Now, this is after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I don't know if you guys remember. Dumped, billions of gallons of oil into Prince William Sound in Alaska. Pictures of sad little puffins covered with oil all over the news for weeks. Okay. So they changed the cartoon tiger to make it more. I'll let you read the quote again.
Today's tiger is now cast in a more humanitarian role. He is polite to the elderly, plans to change their ecology, and has an overall concern for the environment.
Polite to the elderly. I love that. Plants trees for ecology, and has an overall concern for the environment. Wow. Okay. So now you can feel less slimy about being lawyers, because there's always ad execs out there.
And then they started expanding the use of it. And also in the early 1990s, they started to use it to promote food, which is one of the really main important things, as well as their own private label items, like the coffee was called Bengal Traders, and then Wild Tiger, which I don't know what that is. Their use of it increased dramatically from like 92 to 96. But in 93, they sent out this thing to distributors telling them that they had to comply with this new look. And if they didn't do so by like April 1st, 1995, then they were going to be in big trouble. I don't know what that means, but. So they just basically used it in a lot of different like random ways. And then after they started using it to promote food, in 1996, Kellogg filed suit against Exxon. And they originally sought actual and punitive damages, but then they just were looking for injunctive relief. And then the court says, because Exxon asserts the affirmative defenses of laches and acquiescence, and the district court gave them said that laches didn't apply, but gave them acquiescence. So they said that they had to argue acquiescence. And the definition for acquiescence is at the bottom of 513, and it says it requires a finding of conduct on the plaintiff's part that amounted to an assurance to the defendant, expressed or implied, that plaintiff would not assert his trademark rights. Laches requires that they had unreasonably delayed pursuing this litigation and materially prejudiced the infringer. And acquiescence requires that also, but it requires a little more proof than just that. They use the phrase that it implies more active consent, and laches implies like a passive consent. But mere delay was not.
Let me stop you there, because I think the wording of the case is a little confusing there. Acquiescence is really the doctrine where you're talking about consent, either passive or active. Laches just really means that you slept on your rights, you waited too long. And so if you say that laches is passive consent, then you're kind of making consent meaningless. They only mean that it's passive consent in the sense that since you were snoozing instead of enforcing, it can be treated as if it were consent. But I don't like the wording of that case. So just think of it as acquiescence has the consent element. Active or implied. Not really passive, but active or implied. Active, either express or implied. And don't worry about consent with laches. It just makes it confusing.
And so then the court goes into this whole thing about how just delaying is will not bar injunctive relief, like just a little bit of delay. Like it has to be an unreasonable delay, like so much of one that it's like abandonment of their right to litigate or to bring the suit. And then also they go into this analysis about how in order for all of this to have happened, there must have been a legitimate claim for infringement in order to start the delay.
Okay, so let me stop you there just to try to give you a crisp way to write this down. So laches has two elements, prongs. Acquiescence has three. Think about it this way. Laches is unexcusable delay, number one. Number two, causes prejudice. Acquiescence is unexcusable delay, causes prejudice, and there's the implied or express consent. When do you start measuring the delay from? And that is?
The time that the defendant knew or should have known that they had a legitimate claim, that the infringement was legitimate. And so that was like a big issue like later. But the court sort of talks about this problem then that comes up before it talks about progressive encroachment. And it's that, you know, like whether or not when to bring suit, like to wait or not to wait, because then you have to, you know, deal with acquiescence, but then you could bring the suit too early and you don't really have infringement yet, and all these different things. So then it talks about progressive encroachment, like saying that Kellogg was trying to argue that Exxon had was trying to like progressively encroach on their trademark.
So who do, establishing progressive encroachment helps who? The plaintiff or the defendant?
The plaintiff, Kellogg, right?
Right. Okay. So it's sort of an excuse for not bringing suit earlier.
Whether the defendant brought itself more squarely in competition, whether changes in the mark made it closer to the other mark, whether the parties market to the same customers, and whether they sell the products, like whether or not they're interchangeable in use. And then the district court, like I said earlier, said that Kellogg had acquiesced to Exxon's use and could not establish progressive encroachment, and they granted summary judgment. But this court disagreed pretty much with all of that because they had a big problem with the district court's analysis. The district court started by saying that because Kellogg remained quiet for such a long period of time, like over 31 years since Exxon started using their whimsical tiger, that they had acquiesced and that they had not litigated, like that was too long of a period. But this court was saying that the problem was that the original use of the tiger was for the sale of petroleum and not for the use of food. So Kellogg wasn't obligated to bring litigation because there would have been no likelihood of confusion, and they didn't bring litigation because they didn't have a problem. But then when Exxon started selling food products, that's where the delay should be measured from, not from the 31 years. So because Kellogg only sought, like there was a problem originally when they were seeking damages and stuff, but since they were just seeking injunctive relief in connection with the food products, this is okay. And there was a little bit of a dispute about when Kellogg should have known about Exxon's use of the mark and when they should have brought their claim. But either way, the court found that either way it wasn't a gross delay. And therefore, they found against Well, not really against Exxon. They said that affirmative defense didn't apply, and therefore it should go to court, and they should find out whether or not there was likelihood of confusion and whether or not it was actual infringement.
Still, Exxon wasn't real happy.
Right.
Yeah.
And then this is where this court got really angry, because the district court also held that direct competition was dispositive of Kellogg's progressive encroachment claim. And they argued that they were not in the same market because Tiger Mart was selling food, but not their own food, so therefore they were not in direct competition. And they didn't do a likelihood of confusion analysis. And they're basically saying they didn't bring a claim. Like earlier they're saying they didn't bring their claim and they waited too long, and then in this part they're saying, well, it doesn't matter because they didn't have a claim at all. And it was like, well, they go against each other. Like you just said two different things.
Yeah, yeah.
And so basically they like sent everything back to them and said, give me your life now.
Very good. Excellent. Excellent summary. So let me frame one word in your mind, source, and ask you some questions about this. Let me try in the abstract first. Do the doctrines of latches and acquiescence make sense if source is our lodestone for our guiding principle for trademark law? How do you think that relates? One way or the other. Let me try to ask it in a different way. If you are Exxon and Kellogg's has actually, forget about that. If you are Seven-Eleven and you start using a tiger, a cartoon tiger, and Kellogg's comes after you, and as soon as you start using your cartoon tiger, after this Kellogg versus Exxon case, is 7-Eleven going to be able to use a latches or acquiescence defense?
No.
Why not? But they waited a long time to bring their claim against Exxon.
Oh, you're saying like again.
Well, I'm just asking a question. I'm not saying anything. I'm never saying anything. So the acquiescence works against Exxon, but not 7-Eleven. If the court decides, as you initially said, because there was no delay in bringing suit. They didn't acquiesce to 7-Eleven. They just acquiesced to Exxon. So, well, yes, go ahead.
Well, didn't I say that they didn't acquiesce to Exxon?
Well, I'm trying to take it out a step to test the test the doctrine. Very good, though. Thanks. So, if that's the case, then. If in a world where a trademark is supposed to be about indicating source, why is it and about consumer protection, then how does it make sense that we're allowing an affirmative defense that has to do with just the actions of the trademark owner and seems to have nothing to do with public perceptions? See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The public perceptions should be the same either way, right? If they're getting confused between Exxon and Kellogg, then won't they get confused between 7-Eleven and Kellogg?
I mean, I guess so. But I mean, like at some point, like if they waited, and I guess the whole point of this is like if they waited, like so long, it's been like 50, 100 years, they've been confused. I mean, like maybe they were initially confused for like 3 years, but 100 years later, like it's kind of pointless.
So
it.
So you think that if it if this concurrent use goes along long enough, that the public will stop being confused. Maybe at first they see a cartoon tiger, they think Kellogg, but after they've seen enough of the Exxon cartoon tiger, they're thinking, oh, cartoon tiger could be either Kellogg or Exxon. Let me take a closer look. So that's kind of built into consumer perception. That sounds reasonable to me. Okay, so 7-Eleven, not so. Interesting. Mr. Jones, you had a...
I was just going to say this. The longer the delay, then it's not really identified with that source only now, because the consumers will come to identify the other place as another source of the same trademark. The source that supports latches and evidence is the fact that it still is being used to identify the source. Does that make any sense?
Say it again. Rephrase it.
Source isn't going to necessarily protect the trademark as being only applied to that one provider, because people will have to identify the other providers.
Okay, so you're in concurrence with Ms. Blackman in terms of how to reconcile this. Okay, so then my question to both of you, either one of you can answer, is that then why do we need the latches and acquiescence affirmative defenses? Because what you just said is there's no likelihood of confusion, right? Because consumers have learned to distinguish the two. Oh, that's not very satisfying as an explanation. How can we justify this doctrine if it comes down to likelihood of confusion? Can't we just wrap it all up under likelihood of confusion? Mr. Jones?
Can it help the little guy, because they might have trouble with these expensive surveys delay and there's prejudice being caused, the court can go, latches, it's gone, the little guy, you know, can use the trademark, because the big guy's always going to be able to find a way to pay some expert to produce a survey that says there's likelihood of confusion.
Well, that is interesting. That's novel. Not the kind of theory that's very appealing to purists, but it's an interesting realist theory. Huh. Ms. Blackman, anything to say?
Well, I don't know, maybe just from like an efficiency standpoint, like a judicial efficiency standpoint, like it's like, well, if there's probably not likely of a confusion if it's gone by so long and then we can get rid of these things with summary judgment, like why take it to court if we know that it's been 100 years, there's no confusion in 100 years?
Ah, very good. Very good, Judge Posner, some law and economics efficiency. Very good. I like. Both. Very, very good. Wow. Okay. Well, those are good responses. I think it's a very interesting question. Latches and acquiescence are equitable defenses that are applicable in equity generally, and so they make sense with law in general. If you snooze on your rights, you lose them. But there seems to be a special kind of tension when you apply it to trademark. And we have a couple of spirited defenses of continuing to have latches and acquiescence applicable there. But there does seem to be that tension. If they're capable of existing side by side, then apparently there's no likelihood of confusion. So what does that say vis-a-vis third parties or the meaning of the trademark at all? Why should Kellogg have a cause of action? Why should they be able to bring suit and say, hey, you're confusing customers if it's gone on so long that people are capable of distinguishing the two in their mind? Mr. Sachs? Yes, I think a state cause of action for dilution was part of this suit and was edited out. Good point. There was something over here? No? Okay. There's a case where the NAACP sued the NAACP Legal Fund, which were two organizations that had the same genesis but had different board of directors and ended up having different missions, and at some point started having arguments with one another, and the NAACP asked the NAACP Legal Fund to remove the name from its organization, and it was an interesting case where the judge said they've gone on too long with their marks if the NAACP Legal Fund had to change its name now, no one would know what it was. It's too much effort and reputations invested in that mark. So it's interesting because it seems to beg the question of source when that happens, when we say, okay, we're going to let these two live side by side because it's equitable. Then why not let other alleged trademark infringements live side by side? Okay. And also, one thing that occurs to me is, cartoon tiger, so what? I mean, there can only be one cartoon tiger out there. And there's so many tigers. That just seems strange. There's, you know, the Cincinnati Bengals. I assume they sell baby toys with, like, cute tigers. Everyone has the... And so many teams have tigers as their mascot. There's no less than two in the SEC tigers. LSU and Clemson. So... Is that right? Is Clemson part of the ACC?
Auburn
Tigers. That's what I meant. Okay. So, any parting shots about Kellogg versus Exxon? I thought an interesting case. No. Okay, because we get into some drier ones. All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Blackman. That was quite good. Who has Starter versus Converse? Mr. Peterson.
Here we've got obviously two companies that are engaged in apparel manufacturing. This case is 1999. What happened was back in 1988, Starter. shoes, Congress of lawyers caught this and opposed it. They entered into negotiations, which consummated in 1990, in a licensing, in an agreement in which Congress agreed to withdraw its opposition to the trademark application. Consented to start the registration of the plain starter mark for apparel, including footwear, and consented to start the registration of the S and star mark for apparel, excluding footwear. Congress, I guess, is just concerned about confusion of a particular mark that married the S and star on shoes. Then, subsequent to that, in 1995, there was a major change in the apparel industry, which I guess is known as head-to-toe marketing, where universities and other major buyers would buy all of their apparel and shoes from the same company. So, I guess it was a legitimate business concern for Starter, and they essentially went back in and filed an application to use the mark that they had previously agreed not to use on shoes. Congress opposed again, advised Starter that they would sue them for infringement if they proceeded. So Starter actually filed for declaratory judgment.
And what does that mean?
Well, they were seeking a rule from the court basically declaring the rights of parties in the situation.
And how is it that they can do that? What gives them the right to do that?
The statute allows for anyone to sue for declaratory judgment.
What makes something ripe for declaratory judgment? I don't know that it's said explicitly in the case, but based on the context, what do you think it is? It doesn't really reduce litigation, right, because there's either a suit now or there's a suit later. In fact, it might increase litigation because maybe someone would just go into bankruptcy and stop doing business if they waited to sue. Maybe calmer heads would prevail. At least we know we have a suit for declaratory judgment. But I do agree that there's an efficiency interest or something like that at stake. What's that? Right, exactly. Okay. So if you and I are having an argument about what the capital of Latvia is, and can one of us file for declaratory judgment on that?
No, because that's something you could look up.
Well, okay. The problem is that there's nothing riding on that. There's no... you just can't ask the court to declare something. It has to be an actual controversy where one party wants to go forward with some course of action and they don't want to go forward under a threat of litigation. They may change their mind about what they're going to do if the declaratory judgment comes out the other way. If they go in and invest all that money in a certain line of business and then get sued and then wait then to determine their legal rights and they come up the loser, not only have they invested all that money that's useless, but they also may get punitive damages at that point. So they want to settle it up front. Hey, we want to put this mark on shoes. These guys don't want us to court. Is it infringement or not? Okay, so go ahead.
So after the declaratory action was filed, Converse answered the complaint alleging that Starter was stopped either on a contractual basis or on an equitable basis because of their false representation in the previous negotiation that they wouldn't enter into this market. Converse also brought six counterclaims for federal and common law infringement, dilution, unfair competition, which for some reason they then stipulated to do away with, which it doesn't really cover.
Yeah, it doesn't say why. I'm curious, but and frankly, I don't know.
So what ended up happening was the district court denied their summary judgment motions and found the previous 1990 agreement was not a complete integration, therefore was open to extrinsic evidence. The jury returned an affirmative answer, I guess affirmative answer to all four special verdict questions, finding that Starter's use of the S and Star mark on athletic footwear would cause a likelihood of consumer confusion. One. Two, that Starter's use of the composite mark on athletic footwear would cause a likelihood of consumer confusion. And there was a binding, that there was indeed a binding contract, that Starter would not use its marks on athletic shoes. And the Starter was a stop because Starter made oral representations that it would not use the Star marks on athletic shoes. And then, now that that, well, then what happened was that the district court, I guess on its own prerogative, entered an injunction against Starter based on that declaratory judgment. And that's essentially what's up for appeal right now.
And the analysis there is? At the appellate level.
At the appellate level, Converse argued that the injunction was not authorized because they didn't have an opportunity to have a hearing about that. And two, that the injunction was overly broad.
So take those each in turn. In terms of the district court not having authority or jurisdiction to enter an injunction, if Converse hadn't sought it, what was the resolution there?
Well, the appellate court cited 28 U.S.C. 2201 and 2202 that further necessary and proper relief based on declaratory judgment or decree may be granted after reasonable notice of hearing against any adverse party whose rights have been determined by such judgment. They basically said it would be putting form over substance if they didn't uphold sort of the first contention. It was okay for this court to enter an injunction.
Right. So the statute seems to be pretty clear there. They didn't really seem to have much of an argument.
Although I wasn't clear, maybe you can clear up. I thought it said that they didn't notice, it said reasonable notice of hearing. It seemed to me that they didn't really have a notice.
Well, there's not much in the opinion on that. Certainly they had all the proper procedural due process safeguards with regard to the substantive issue. They defended that tooth and nail. They had a hearing on that. They had notice for that. They defended all that. What they're saying is we needed a separate hearing and notice on the fact that there was an injunction on the table. But what seems to trump that is this other statute that says, or it's actually Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 54C, which says, this is in the middle of 524, second part of the first sentence in the third paragraph. Every final judgment shall grant the relief to which the party in whose favor it is rendered is entitled, even if the party has not demanded such relief in the party's pleadings. Well, that seems pretty clear. So. The other statutory site on its own might offer an argument, but that really seems pretty clear. So, the court says makes more sense because we don't need to have a second trial just to see if there's an injunction here. The court thought that it was the right thing to do to enter an injunction, so they did. Now, what about the injunction being too broad?
However, they found the injunction broad because it should apply only to the marks when used on athletic footwear and when used alone on athletic footwear, not necessarily in conjunction with other marks. We had a, there was a previous shoe that was a co-sponsorship another brand or something they put the mark on. So they basically ended up remanding it back to district court saying drop a new injunction that's narrower in scope that fits only Strata marks on athletic shoes by themselves.
Why do you think it was necessary to appeal this? Why couldn't the Strata attorneys call up Converse and say, look, there's no support for the all footwear injunction. Can you just agree with us that it should say all athletic footwear and we'll sign a document saying that? Why wouldn't that have worked?
Well, because the court entered it. I mean, it still would have been criminal.
Exactly. The court entered the order, yeah. So they can't, even if Converse, they can't just change the order by themselves.
I would imagine the two parties could have gotten together and requested the court issue an injunction with a different language.
That was my second question. So why not just say, hey, you guys know this is some kind of mistake. How about we both write a letter to the court together and we'll start to get back to being friends in the shoe business, you know, and we'll just go, hey, it should say athletic footwear. So what do you think happened there? Why didn't that happen? That's certainly possible. It's certainly possible that there was so much enmity built up, people were so nasty to one another that they just weren't on speaking terms. It's too bad, you know. It's one reason that it's good for lawyers to litigate things rather than clients. You know, I mean, if it's just client versus client on the phone, things would never get done. When it's lawyer versus lawyer, a lot of times, lawyers can speak very detachedly and clinically about things and say, look, what's a good way both of us can get rid of this? And I've had cases both ways. I've had cases where I'm on the phone with the other guys and they're like, yeah, well, you know, we've got this indemnity theory, so we're kind of just suing everybody. It doesn't really matter if these particular cases have merit or not. It's going to work out well economically for our clients, so we have to pursue it. And I know that you guys, it's not going to make sense to defend it, so we're just looking for a settlement for a reasonable fund, a reasonable amount, so we can both walk away from this. And it was highway robbery, but it was true, and you know it was at least enough to go forward. And okay, we'll write you a check. How about, what do you want? No, that's too much. How about this? And no, well, how about we just cut it down a little bit? Well, okay, you guys have been nice. We just want to go on to these other indemnity claims in this complex litigation. We signed a check and we were done with it. As opposed to other litigations I've had where I had one, a patent holder immersion corporation versus Sony and Microsoft for the technology that causes joysticks to vibrate for Xbox and PlayStation. And relations were so bad with the Sony counsel that this is actually after I left the law firm, they ended up suing the law firm for not, I don't know if they sued the law firm or if they instituted a separate suit about accusing us of destroying documents or something. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was absolutely crazy. And part of the problem that, part of the reason that the discovery was such a mess in this case, frankly, is because these are American, on the other side, were American attorneys representing Sony, and Japanese companies don't really understand litigation very well because Japan just gets along pretty much without lawyers. It's changing a little bit, but it's a very non-litigious culture, corporate culture over there. So when they get a document demand and it says turn over all these documents, they're like, no. And I'm sure that if Weil Gotchel had said, you know, look, you have to, that's the American system, they'd say, well, just tell them we won't. So Weil Gotchel was really forced to fight everything tooth and nail. Sometimes you could tell they would just rather turn over the documents, but their client wouldn't let them because of how they thought. At any rate, it ended up becoming very, very, very nasty. And after I left, there was some extra proceedings, which I don't know exactly what they were. But the point is that lawyers are people too, and lawyers have to, you know, have good relationships with opposing counsel and bad relationships with opposing counsel, and it makes a big difference for your client in the end. It's really better to have good relations with opposing counsel. Some clients really want to see you go in there and beat up on people. Don't give any deadline extensions. Give them hell, you know? Don't give in on anything. And that's not good for anyone. But that is, and something I hadn't thought of, Mr. Peterson, but that's an excellent point, that is one possible explanation for this, is that they just got along so poorly at this point in the case, they just weren't talking to one another. Mr. Jones? I wouldn't call it a little guy. It was a patent holding company. There was a big multi-million dollar verdict against Sony. I don't know what happened after that in terms of appeals. Microsoft settled out. If you ever have to take a deposition in Japan, it's very complicated, but I know exactly how to do it. You need a special deposition visa to enter the country with the intent to take a deposition. It's illegal to enter Japan with the intent to take a deposition unless you have a deposition visa. I'm at the airport in Osaka, Kansai, and the Japanese immigration authorities see my passport with this big visa and my picture and all this stuff, and they say, ah, deposition, and they show it to the other immigration officer. Deposition. No one had ever seen this before, and I'm like going, okay, I'm going to be here for like 8 hours. I'm going to be thrown in jail because it looks like I'm coming through with some document that doesn't exist. They were like, oh, they were very interested, and they said, okay, and they stamped it, and I went. So, but apparently they'd never seen it before. So, other possible explanations for why they didn't do that. It's possible that Converse decided to say, hey, we'll do it, but for a fee. Maybe they were holding out for a little bit of money at that point. I'm not sure. Maybe the clients hated one another at that point. Maybe the lawyers hated one another at that point. So maybe they did, and the district court said no, because the district court was sick of dealing with things at that point. But it sure seems kind of ridiculous. An interesting question to ask is to really look at those jury form and think, if you'd just taken the word athletic out of there, would the jury have really done anything different on the form? 12 people hanging out in a government building trying to get home, would they have really said, well, all footwear, that's just a little bit too much, you know? So it goes to show you how important verdict forms are, because he put all this work into a case. It all comes down to this verdict form, and it can really create a problem in terms of bases for injunctions and appeals later on. They really have to be carefully thought out, and even if they're extremely carefully thought out, that doesn't always clear all the problems with them. Let me ask you this final question, Mr. Peterson. The jury that thought that consumers would be confused by Starter's mark on shoes. You have some familiarity with the Converse brand and the Starter brand?
I actually have two pictures in front here.
But do you personally? Okay. Do you think you'd be confused?
Probably not.
What is the sense of the class? They think that among your peers, don't try to think about it, people you've never met, but among your peers, how many people think there are people among your peers who would be confused when they saw a Starter mark on shoes that it was from the same source as the Converse Chucks? One person? Two people? How about people that think, no, there would be no likelihood of confusion? More people? That actually wins over the non-voting people, which is unusual in this class. Okay. I guess that, yeah, the apathetic went home for Thanksgiving. Okay, yeah, so I personally have a hard time believing that that there could be likelihood of confusion there. People who buy sports apparel, talk about the level of sophistication of consumers. Someone who's, you know, caring about head-to-toe, same brand of something, people who drop a lot of money on sneakers, they care. I think that they know that stuff. They know that three stripes is Adidas and four stripes isn't. They know the Nike Swoosh from the Payless Shoe Source Blurble. I mean, they know. They know. That in the middle of that head-to-toe thing, I was in Berkeley, California. I saw this guy who was dressed head-to-toe in burnt orange Longhorns stuff. And I said, oh, Hook'em Horns. And he said, he just looked at me like, what are you doing? I'm like, Hook'em Horns. And he said, and he just like, what are you doing? I said, well, you go to the University of Texas, Hook'em Horns. He says, no, I just like the colors. Okay, we'll return with part two in 5 minutes.